Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway, the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Kuinos Hermes, a deep bow of gratitude and reverence to Sophia. Last time we reflected on ecological thinking. I think it's been a little while. Can't remember where we're at. I know we've stuck a few episodes in between some interviews. I hope you caught those. But when we thought about ecological thinking, we touched on something that might at first seem merely poetic. Thinking like a mountain. We've often considered the notion that we need to integrate our thinking, so that we don't create a duality between the head and the heart, a duality between reason and intuition, mind and body, or mind and nature. And that means thinking like a mountain is not merely poetic, but also scientific, if we consider it holistically. Gregory Bateson had no interest in woo-woo speculations. And yet he realized that the world operates in such a way that we can speak rigorously about the idea of thinking like a mountain. In the book Angel's Fear, Bateson writes the following. Quote, what has been said so far can be read as argument or evidence for the reality of very large mental systems, systems of ecological size and larger, within which the mentality of the single human being is a subsystem. That's a wild thing for him to suggest. That's the end of the quote. I should have said end quote, but my head's spinning, isn't yours? Because Bateson means mountains and forests arise as mental systems. Such systems can even operate at planetary scale. And humans function as subsystems in larger ecologies of mind. Even the human being itself is an ecology, and our ego, our very sense of self in habitual experience, is a mere subsystem in the larger ecology of the psyche. Your psyche, my psyche. Sometimes we say things like that, my soul, my psyche, my mind. But the one speaking, the I that says my soul, my psyche, my mind, that is inside the ecology. That is a part, a subsystem. Now, we should be clear that Bateson was ultimately a bit more conservative than even some scientists, let alone some of the mystical philosophers who have touched the wonders of larger ecologies of mind. Still, his views offer us a sense of wonder, and they will help us to bridge to the other theme of our contemplation, the myth of freedom. We're calling this contemplation the myth of freedom and the way of mountain thinking. As a way to lay some context for a concrete practice of thinking like a mountain, because we want it to be concrete. It's not just a turn of phrase. Oh, thinking like a mountain, that sounds nice, but how would we practice it? So to lay some context for a practice of thinking like a mountain and a way to realize true freedom, let's consider some more of what Bateson has to say about large mental systems, systems of which we as individuals are only a small part, but also systems as large as a single human being, or a human romantic relationship, or a human family, or a human collaboration. Maybe a human collaboration at relatively large scale. All human activity arises already interwoven into or as ecologies that go beyond the merely human. So each of us needs to think about large mental systems in a variety of ways. We're just talking about our life, in other words. It seems fancy, large mental systems, but we have friends, don't we? We have families. We have collaborations. We work together. We could heal the world together, but not if we don't understand how these systems work. These things affect our lives. This is our life. We're talking about our life, not an abstraction. And we cannot learn to think the way nature works. To think the way nature works. Unless we get a better sense of how interwovenness exhibits mind at scales much larger than our habitual consciousness. So here are some more of Bateson's reflections from Angel Sphere. It's worth reading. I'll let you know when we get to the end. So bear with me. Bateson writes, well, his daughter finished the book. So she was working from notes that he wrote. So some of this comes directly from notes that he wrote. And we're just going to attribute these passages to Bateson. So here's what he writes. These large mental systems are characterized by, among other things, constraints on the transmission of information between their parts. Indeed, we can argue from the circumstance that some information should not reach some locations in large organized systems to assert the real nature of these systems, to assert the existence of that whole whose integrity would be threatened by inappropriate communication. It's a subtle thing. I hope you're following along there. He's saying that some things have to stay unconscious in some systems. So continuing, he says, by the word real in this context, I mean simply that it is necessary for explanation to think in terms of organizations of this size, attributing to these systems the characteristics of mental process. And that's as defined by the criteria that we already went over in an earlier episode. But it is one thing, writes Bateson, to claim that this is necessary and not surprising, and quite another to go on to say, however vaguely, what sort of mind such a vast organization might be. What characteristics would such minds expectably show? Are they, perhaps, the sort of thing that human beings have called gods? What mental characteristics are to be expected in any large mental system or mind, the basic premises of whose character shall coincide with what we claim to know of cybernetics and systems theory? Starting from these premises, we surely cannot arrive at a lineal billiard ball materialism. Now, if they're getting lost here, this is Nico's coming back in, stay with it. He's asking, what is it like if I say that mountains think that they are a mental system? What kind of mental system is that? Could it be like a god? And he says, well, if we consider scientifically, because he's being very precise and rigorous, he says, well, this kind of mind can't be a billiard ball materialistic mind. And we still kind of have that going on in our science today, a little bit. So let's just finish this passage with him, and we'll think it through. Bateson says, but what sort of religion we shall develop is not clear. Two things, however, are clear about any religion that might derive from cybernetics and systems theory, ecology and natural history. First, that in the asking of questions there will be no limit to our hubris. And second, that there shall always be humility in our acceptance of answers. In these two characteristics, we shall be in sharp contrast with most of the religions of the world. They show little humility in their espousal of answers, but great fear about what questions they will ask. Okay, that's the end of the passage. Of course, he's being a little bit snooty there. Because, as we've tried to say, the mystics are very willing to ask the hard questions and very willing to humiliate themselves to find out the answers. Their humility knows no bounds. You will be humiliated, as many mystics have taught us. That doesn't mean that they don't arrive at some real confidence and insight as they enter into the mystery. But it's exciting to sense how Bateson invites us to go where angels fear to tread. In our last contemplation of ecological thinking, we introduced the idea of thinking like a mountain, but this passage from Bateson, as well as our general discussion of ecological thinking, reveals to us that we may not actually know what thinking itself is. How can we talk about thinking like a mountain or thinking in any good way or bad way? How do we criticize each other's thinking? How do we think better if we don't know what thinking is? If scientifically speaking, Bateson is right, we're just being hard, rigorous thinkers here. Ha ha. And we accept science. And if a scientific definition of mind invites us to see that mountains think, and if humans might think best by thinking the way mountains think, well, then what in the world is thinking? Do you feel that you think like a mountain? We all think like humans, but maybe that's not good thinking. We seem to suffer from an implicitly and inherently transcendent orientation toward mind. We imagine mind is something that I do. So the word thinking for us refers to something done by the I, by the egocentric self. Descartes famously said, "I think, therefore I am." We've all heard that. But Bateson and Buddha and the mountain all reply to him, "Think again, my friend." All of them, Bateson, Buddha, and the mountain, say to Descartes and to us, because we have that same bias of I think. All of us have to think again. We all imagine this I think and this I am. And when I say we all, I mean people under the sway of the dominant culture. And even if we were in a culture rooted in wisdom, love, and beauty, we'd have to overcome this habit, it seems. It seems that we don't come into the world and arrive at adulthood free of this habit. We somehow need to find a way out of this trap. And we're right now trapped in this. This is the trap we're in. Why is the world a mess? This. We don't know how to think. You can't think a good world into being if you have yourself thinking in precisely the wrong way. This supposed I that does the thinking is not the whole of ourselves. It's part. Once we begin to see ourselves as an ecology, and once we relax and release into the notion that mind is immanent in ecologies, that it does not ride above them, then we can shift. You see this? I know that it might be subtle. What do we mean when it's imminent? You can't say, I think, because that thing saying, I think, is a subsystem. The thinking is happening in the whole ecology, and something called the I wants to take credit for it. But we all know this in our own experience. You didn't come up with your best ideas. They came to you. And you don't even know if they came from the ecology that's supposedly bounded by a bag of skin that you put your name on. Our best ideas definitely don't come just from that bag of skin ecology. Our culture seduces us into fancying that we are above the ecology of our own mind, and also above the ecologies of the world we share. And that doesn't make any sense. Not scientifically, not even spiritually. We are these ecologies, not something separate. But the habit drives us. And if we can begin to resist that habit, if we begin to say, no, 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 I'm not going to be pulled into this mess. I'm not going to stay pulled in because we're in it, we're entangled in it, we're encumbered by it. As we begin to say no, that noble nay, we begin to approach one of the most beautiful teachings from the wisdom traditions of the world. And in particular, I'm thinking about a vast literature in Chinese philosophy that works with the principle of Li. Even the word physics incorporates this principle as Wu Li. That's the word for physics. And the Sino-Japanese words for logic and psychology have Li in them. And that word relates to patterning. So Wu Li as physics has to do with the patterning of the world. And the great philosopher Dogen, following the Indian sage Bodhidharma, he uses a word in Japanese, it would be do-ri, or in Chinese, dao-li. And that means the way of reason. Dao-li, or do-ri in Japanese. Now, dao, you recognize that word, that's the way, as in the Tao Te Ching, and then that word li. Why does Dogen use that word to define meditation? You might be thinking, how did we get onto this? Stay with me. Bodhidharma, this great sage, he says there are two ways to practice philosophy. And this is intricate enough that we're going to return to it. So don't just get with me here one time. We're going to walk through this and it'll make more sense and then we'll come back to it. But this guy, Bodhidharma, good philosopher, famous philosopher, he said there are two ways to practice philosophy. Practice with the mind and practice with the body. Practice with the mind, he called Dao Li, the way of reason. And this practice is defined as meditation. Now we're thinking about this because we're questioning what thinking is. And one way to get at why meditation would be called the way of reason involves sensing that whatever we mean by reason has to become transcended and yet not defiled, a kind of synthesis of apparent opposites. That's what we've been talking about. How do we get past this division between the head and the heart, between mind and nature, self and world? And how do we understand differently what thinking is? And you see where we're headed here. If meditation is reasoning, uh-oh. Now, in a famous passage, Dogen describes a spiritual common law case. And it goes like this. Once, when the great master Hung Dao of Yue Sha was sitting in meditation, a monk asked him, "What are you thinking, sitting there so fixedly?" The master answered, "I am thinking of not thinking." The monk asked, "How do you think of not thinking?" The master answered, "Non-thinking." We have to avoid over-intellectualizing cases of spiritual common law, but if we approach with care, we can work with these concepts as follows. Thinking in this passage means habitual mind and its conscious purposes, which we follow without really seeing what they are. We just go following all of our thoughts. Not thinking means an interruption of this, a preliminary rupture that marks the beginning of a spiritual philosophical life. That's when we get stopped. Our own crazy, just finally we say, what am I doing? I remember once, here's a silly example of this, my godfather told me how he quit smoking. He worked in the steel mills, and somebody asked him a question. He set down the cigarette he was smoking to answer the question, and then he went off and somebody else stopped him, and he just habitually, without a cigarette in his hand, lit up another one and started smoking it and started talking to this fellow. And in the middle of this conversation, he set the cigarette down. And then somebody else came and grabbed him, and he went to go deal with that, and not having a cigarette in his mouth, habitually he lit up another one. And after he finished that conversation, he looked at the cigarette in his hand and realized there were two others that were burning. It suddenly dawned on him. And he thought, this is ridiculous. And he saw that he was trapped in this habit. So he threw the whole rest of the pack away, and that was that. Not everybody can quit smoking that easily. He didn't see that this is just the human predicament. A little bit he saw it. That's why, as a godfather, he was telling his godchild the story. So not thinking means we kind of say no to this. Non-thinking, how did we get to that? Well, that means the non-dualistic functioning of a better way of knowing, which cannot be called thinking in the normal sense, since our habitual notion of thinking involves a thinker, the limited ego. And we have forgotten that when we practice non-thinking. So Dogen uses this story to introduce the practice of meditation. The student sees the master, says, what are you thinking there? You're so still. And that's sometimes what we do. I need to think. And we sit. Sometimes we don't sit. We can't sit still. But the student asks, what are you thinking? The master says, I'm thinking of not thinking. So that's the no. I'm done with thinking. The student says, well, how do you do that? How do you think of not thinking? And the master says, non-thinking. And here's how Dogen uses that to explain meditation. He writes, once you have regulated your posture, take a breath and exhale fully. Swing to the left and right, sitting fixedly. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of zazen. Now that's the Japanese word for dhyana, which is a Sanskrit word that refers to a kind of meditation. So he's sort of saying this is the essential art of meditation, but then the next sentence is odd. He writes, this is the essential art of zazen. Zazen is not the practice of meditation. It is just the reality gate of ease and joy. It is the practice and verification of ultimate awakeness, the fundamental point of wisdom realized. Baskets and cages cannot get to it. Wow. That's a wild passage. So if you went to Dogen for meditation instruction, he would say, well, look, I don't teach meditation. I teach the reality gate of ease and joy. I teach the practice and verification of ultimate awakeness, the fundamental point of wisdom realized, and all your baskets and cages can't get to it. And that's our baskets and cages of habitual concepts. So Dogen is not talking about meditation in the sense of something cut off from life. He is talking about a threshold, a bardo, an entrance to the joyfulness of reality. We want to make clear that a holistic sense of reason has to do with patterning in nature that we can touch with a mind of meditation. Isn't that already a beautiful shift, to think that nature's way of reasoning has to do with patterning that we can gain intimate contact with when we arrive at a truly meditative mind? And we're talking about a participatory orientation. That's important. It's to say that meditation is the gateway to participating in the joy of life. Now, even relatively accomplished philosophers will teach meditation as silence in contrast to thinking. So this is a very strange definition. You're not going to find a whole lot of sort of ordinary, everyday meditation teachers saying, oh, yes, I teach you reasoning. I'm going to teach you the way of reason. And of course, there's something to be said for the stuff we think of when we think of reasoning. If we sit down and read Nagarjuna, but Nagarjuna was a yogi also. So he was offering us something related to what Dogen is offering us. So it's very subtle here, nuanced territory that we're in. So meditation teachers will say things like, well, just because your mind isn't quiet doesn't mean you aren't meditating. Now, that's a good thing to say. Even if your mind makes a lot of noise, that can still be very good meditation. Because one way to look at meditation is that it's the way we become intimate with our own mind. It's how we become familiar with our own mind. When we notice the noise, which usually we don't really, 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 really know how much noise is there. We have to look. We have to listen. And when we really, sometimes this is such a common thing. People have told me this, and you'll find most meditation teachers have heard it, that somebody will say, well, when I can't meditate because when every time I sit down to meditate, my mind just gets so noisy. It gets noisy. They think the meditation causes it. And it is simply that they've never really registered how much noise their mind makes. A lot of people might think they know, but they don't really know because they've never actually listened. So if you were to sit down and notice the noise, that's an accomplishment. And that means it's a very good meditation. Just to sit and notice all the noise does a lot of good for us. It begins a healing process. Nevertheless, teachers of meditation would lie to you if they said, the mind will never become silent. You will always have a bunch of noise in your mind. That's not true. And so if somebody is teaching you meditation, if they don't say, well, eventually silence will come, they're leaving something out. It will come. And there's no failure in the meantime. You can enjoy success every step of the way. But eventually, yes, the mind establishes itself in silence. Or we could say the mind reveals silence as indigenous to itself, certain measure of silence, which is ultimately not separate from any noise. But this is a silence we don't have to manufacture. That's the important thing. Now, some teachers of meditation will say things like this. Silence is more productive of wisdom and clarity than thinking is. And you will find this kind of attitude, that we only have to engage in thinking when it's quote-unquote necessary, whatever that means. We think when necessary, and the rest of the time, the mind can be silent. Now, that's not terrible to suggest the mind can be silent when we don't have to engage in some kind of explicit cogitation or dialogue. But I think we can see how this reflects or becomes an implicitly transcendent view of thinking. Thinking is something I do above myself somehow when I need to leave the silence. Whereas if we had the right view of thinking, we would realize that in meditation, when we arrive at that silence, we have arrived at thinking. Pure thinking without any thought in it. Without the habitual patterns of thought trapped in ignorance, grasping, and aversion. After all, what else is wisdom but the most skillful and graceful thinking? And what a shift to relate to our life this way. When we arrive at that silence, we arrive at thinking. In a way, we arrived at thinking for the first time when we arrive at that silence. To walk mindfully with presence and awareness, but without habitual thought, that requires thinking without any doing or any doer. And as the sense of I think begins to relax, as egocentric habits of thought relax into silence and spaciousness, then actual thinking comes to the fore. The fuller energy, capacity, and potential of the mind begins to reveal itself, and we begin to recognize with even greater clarity all the times in our lives when, essentially, the best thinking we did happened all by itself, underneath all the noise of our habitual mind. We find a clarity and a sacred, creative ordering emerging in place of the disorder, the discoordination, the dullness that characterize habitual thought. So we can say that what habitual mind does is thought. That's one way we could make a distinction. We're talking about thinking when we're not in the habitual mind, and we can say it's thought. It's a repetition. It's a kind of encumbered, incoherent, and discoordinated version of something which in its liberated expression does not create a duality between silence and sound, does not create a duality between knower and known, and does not imply a false transcendence, but emerges as something synchronistic, well-ordered, luminous, and clear. It has the characteristics of wildness. And so really shifting into thinking like a mountain means we have to get to the silence and stability of a mountain, as well as the wisdom and wildness of a mountain. We have to establish ourselves eventually in a kind of silence, clarity, spaciousness, and spontaneous presence and responsiveness, the likes of which our habitual mind has never known. And we have to recognize how subtle that transcendent view of mind is. Again, by transcendent, we mean a view that sees thinking somehow separate from the wholeness, as somehow over and above the wholeness and beyond the wildness. If we are ecologies, and that's just to say, if the definition of mind, your mind, my mind, if we define that mind the way Bateson did, carefully, rigorously, not because he was trying to force us into being an ecology, but because he was trying to understand how mind works. And when you look at the definition of mind, when you look at the neuroscience and the cognitive science, and you look at actual empirical research, you find a sense of thinking that we must accept as imminent, totally interwoven. We are ecologies. So mind cannot sit on top of those ecologies, and it of necessity has the character of wildness and creative responsiveness. And that means aspects of thinking, real thinking, are simply not part of our habitual conscious experience, the experience of the egocentric habits, with all their reactivity, ignorance, grasping, and aversion. When we enter into that wild silence, we allow the holistic thinking to truly function. And it will deliver what it needs to into the relative working space that we call consciousness. But of course, we will, in the process, become more awake and aware. And so that sense of even what consciousness is begins to shift. The sense of what the I is, me, mine, I, all the sense of what that is begins to shift. We begin to enter into our own vastness. And that also nourishes us because we find that we're not separate from the mountain. We belong to each other. We and the world belong to each other. We and the mountain belong to each other. You and I belong to each other. And if we and the mountain belong to each other, the stability of the mountain becomes our stability. The life of the mountain becomes our life. That's true of the whole community of life. The life of the coral reef, the life of the oceans, the life of the rivers and forests. Oh, that's a big shift. And once that expansiveness gets broad and deep enough, we arrive at real fearlessness because, well, we have nothing to fear. We truly, truly have nothing to fear. And right now we're driven by so much fear. What would it be to arrive at fearlessness, even a little bit, to arrive at peace? And what would it be to arrive at true freedom? True freedom, which is a core characteristic of wildness. That can feel surprisingly frightening because of how that freedom would go together with interwovenness. As with our uncritical views about thinking, our uncritical views about freedom involve a transcendence. We imagine freedom means transcending life, and we think the ego becomes free. I'm free. I think. I am. In the dominant culture, especially in the U.S., we find a lot of obsession with freedom. The U.S. sees itself as the land of the free and the home of the brave. And we've just considered how true fearlessness exists only as a spiritual realization, not a political declaration. And freedom, too, exists only as a spiritual realization, not as a political declaration. We can declare it as important to our culture and therefore educate our citizens toward it, but we cannot legislate it. We may fancy ourselves free when we can do whatever we like. In this culture, freedom comes down to a monetary proposition or a declaration of will. We may have little money, but we consider it an act of freedom, courage, and independence when we leave a job we hate. And in some sense, it's not a completely useless idea. We really do have more freedom than we may realize. Well, of course, we have more freedom than we realize, or we'd be free. At the same time, we get driven largely by the longing for a freedom to do whatever we want because we have all the money we need to empower us. That's what we end up longing for. It's the shortcut to freedom, money. Money provides an immediate sense of freedom from material concerns. And we have limited material resources. We can feel trapped in a job, trapped in a relationship, trapped in a whole life situation. If our car breaks, we ourselves can feel broken if we have no money to fix it. And yet we rely on that car to get by in our day-to-day existence. We need the car to get to the job, to pay for the car, to get to the job. Some people can't relate to this. This might not be your context. You might have enough material stability that you don't really worry about it. There's plenty of people in this world, and definitely in the U.S. culture, they can't even countenance the possibility that their car might break down because they don't know what they would do. Trapped. The culture has arranged itself in such a way that money allows us to buy relative freedom, a relative freedom that has a meaning in this context. But when we sit down to meditate, this sense of freedom reveals itself as an abstraction and a delusion. How can we consider ourselves free with such a chaotic mind? We have no real clarity and stability of mind. When we sit down to meditate, we discover a mind filled with noise, unable to perceive the true nature of ourselves or our world. We discover a mind of incoherence, contradictions, tensions, fears, aggressions. Again, the title of this contemplation is The Myth of Freedom and the Way of Mountain Thinking. And I don't mean that we have a myth of freedom in the dominant culture. In fact, we have a delusion of freedom, and we need a myth to correct that delusion. Sometimes we use the word myth in a pejorative sense. The phrase the myth of freedom could mean something like the falsehood of freedom. You might have been thinking, you're talking about the myth of freedom. We think we're free, but we're not. So it's a myth. No, we're going to call that delusion. The notions of freedom in the dominant culture are delusions. And we want to think about myth in its positive denotation. In the positive sense, mythology helps to organize our experience and potentiate us to our fuller capacities. Myths make use of archetypal images that prime the psyche to transcend the limitations we have imposed on it. It's a different sense of transcendence. Transcending limitations. We lack a mythology of freedom, at least as an essence of our culture, something that's at the heart of our culture. There are mythologies of freedom available to us, but we don't really have it at the center of the culture. And that's why we find ourselves so trapped in delusions about freedom. And we do have stories that support the delusions. The Horatio Alger story. And it has many incarnations. It's almost like the Horatio with 1,000 faces. That's a riff on Joseph Campbell's Hero with 1,000 faces. And these stories, in a way, they serve as a warning that no mythology has full immunity to spiritual materialism. And that warning holds even more strongly for fragmented and fragmenting stories that don't really count as an authentic mythology. The delusions of a culture will naturally try to tap into the energies of the psyche and manipulate them. So that means our stories tap into mythological currents. But they never achieve a proper mythology because they limit us and cut us off from spiritual and ecological realities rather than helping us realize our fullest potentials in attunement with spiritual and ecological realities. I mean, if you consider the Horatio Alger story, it's about a young man. Of course, it's a young man who pulls himself up by his own bootstraps. That's not a very ecological story. So there's no spiritual or ecological attunement. It's just a little sovereign individual, an atom, a bag of skin, who wanted freedom and got money. Wanted meaning, got money. If we integrate mythopoetic vision with critical thinking, that could actually empower us. We need the magic of the archetypal energies and the synchronicities they can unleash. We find a simple yet empowering example of a good mythology of freedom in the story of Buddha. We won't go into all the details of that mythology and its wondrously, beautifully, incredibly elaborated philosophy, but we can at least bring to mind the image of Buddha sitting under that cosmic tree of awakening, sitting at the very axis of our world, and arriving at true freedom. Although we have to admit that we do not know the freedom Buddha realized, we certainly do have a sense of the pointlessness of a lot of our thought, our patterns of thought that we're trapped in. We can recognize how unfree our habitual and effectively compulsive patterns of thought make us. That's part of why we aren't free. We're just compelled by these patterns of thought, like my godfather and his cigarette, going from one to the next to the next. In his version of the story, there were like at least 5 cigarettes. I just can't picture it, but that's how he told me the story. I told you there were 3. I just think maybe that was a good myth he was telling me. The point is, our habitual patterns of thought have a samsaric quality, a repetitive, bondage-like quality. We get bound. We are bound. Now, all of this differs from the relative dance we need between liberation and constraint. That's a separate issue. In this bondage of thought, we get caught up, really trapped, constrained, and fragmented by habitual patterns of misguided thought. It's like a mirror image of the patterning of nature. I mean that it's a reversed image, like it's a funny mirror image or it's a caricature image of the patterning of nature, which is nature's thinking. We get caught up in noise. But of course, even the noise isn't fully, completely noise in the most technical sense, because underneath all of it is still actual thinking. The noisy mind, though, involves limited and limiting patterns of reactivity, judgment, aggression, craving, clinging, manipulation, and control. The last two might be the most important in some ways. Well, ignorance is the biggest error, but that drives us to manipulate and control everything. And this is why this habitual pattern, this caricature of thinking, it's not the living, loving thinking of the world. This thing that we have got caught in, trapped in, that is why so many spiritual teachers emphasize the uselessness of thought. And we can find it a very important truth in saying we can't think ourselves into liberation, in that limited sense. But we also have to recognize that liberation doesn't mean we become zombies. Liberation does not mean the end of thinking. Instead, it means the beginning of thinking. the beginning of skillful, creative, holistic thinking, vitalizing thinking, life-enhancing thinking, synchronistic thinking, Sophianic thinking. I mean, Dogen was telling us that we can think ourselves into liberation if we enter that reality gate of joy. Liberation, the mythology of freedom, what does it point us to? It points us to the end of encumbered patterns of thought, especially the elaborations of thought referred to in the Pali language as papanka. That's the word for it. This kind of elaboration, this wheel spinning. When we cut off the papanka, when we cut off all that clump, that mess of our these cycles of habitual ignorance, all the lit cigarettes that we've got all over the place, and then we light another and we light another. When we cut off all that, then we enter into original thinking, the primordial thinking of nature, the thinking of the wild. At that moment, our thinking becomes the thinking of wisdom, love, and beauty. It becomes the synchronicity of heart, mind, body, world, and cosmos. It becomes part of how the world holds itself together and furthers itself along. Because evolution thought us into being, or you can say the divine thought us into being, or both. We don't want to give up the process that thought us into being. Instead, we want to give up its encumbered expressions, the caricatures of it. We can get trapped in patterns of thought and in a whole style of thought that is itself suffering. It is itself suffering, and therefore cannot ever actually heal our suffering. We can't heal the world this way. And this is a very nuanced thing because of the shift we would need to make to arrive at ecological thinking, holistic spiritual thinking, Sophianic thinking. It definitely differs from our habitual patterns of thought. But even habitual patterns of thought can seem like genius thinking to us at times. People like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs, they manifested these patterns of thought that we view as intelligent and even creative. But those patterns of thought, as seductive as they can seem to us, as impressive as they can seem to us, they differ from the thinking of nature, the thinking indigenous to the soul, the thinking of wisdom, love, and beauty, the thinking of the great mystery, the thinking of the divine. That thinking, and the thinking of many seemingly intelligent people, are not the same thing. Now, ultimately, they're not completely different. They can't be. Not in an interwoven world. So the subtlety here has a lot of depth to it, a lot of nuance. Because it's not as if we can do something too different from what we are. But it does matter to understand how encumbered or how liberated the expression of what we are is as it comes through us. That makes a world of difference. In fact, it makes a different world. The important note here is not to give up on thinking, but to let go of all those patterns of thought that go together with our suffering and the suffering of the world. And we want to open up to the possibility that we find real thinking in silence, in a meditative mind. And of course, we also fall into it I want to emphasize, fall. What's like, we trip and fall. We fall into it. All the time. Because it's indigenous to the soul. It's how we get our best ideas. But we also get the negative consequences of some of those best ideas because we weren't really in attunement, you see. And that relates to the difference between ecological thinking and what we often refer to as genius thinking. You know, we get confused because we don't know. We're missing it, you see. Not very long ago, I heard a person talking about Elon Musk, and this person was saying, well, on balance, Elon Musk is a net positive. That's what term this guy used. He said he's a net positive. That's when we're calculating something, we say, oh, what's my net profit, you know? And we can't really think about life that way. It doesn't work. It's such a, I just was somewhat astonished listening to this. Even if we could think that way, should we think of Elon Musk as a net positive? I'm really not sure he is. I'm not sure this fellow really believed it either. But the person definitely did recognize the problem in saying that. He acknowledged it. And he said, you know, look, well, when I say net positive, I guess we really do have to get down to the nitty-gritty and ask, well, what are the downsides? What are the harms people like Elon Musk create on the way to doing something that overall I want to call a net positive? And now I'm saying I don't agree it's positive. I'm not so sure. It does seem that Elon Musk sees himself as saving the world. I think a lot of other people might feel that way with Tesla. We talk about the EV revolution. It's kind of funny. The electric vehicle revolution. Like that's going to save us. I don't think so. Because all of that stuff comes from the same style of thought that got us into the problem. It's not reason, according to Dogen. It's not reason according to Plato or Nagarjuna either. It doesn't matter which way we look at reasoning. And I think all of this shows us how important ecological thinking is. It means a shift in the style of our thinking altogether. And I would say that Elon Musk's action in the world is a net negative because it doesn't come from this kind of thinking that we need, that Buddha and Bateson and the mountain tell us we need. And they tell us this with just rigor, clarity, not because they're waxing philosophical in the negative sense, you know. And we're not evaluating Elon Musk as a sentient being. We're just evaluating his action in the world and the style of thinking that it comes from. Now, we'll find out in time, of course. But the idea is that any time we aren't rooted in ecological thinking, any time we're not truly free, any time we're not in attunement with a mythology of freedom and with the thinking of mountains, we're going to cause problems. And when we fall for the metaphor of power, we talked about that in an earlier contemplation, we think that somebody like Elon Musk has a lot of power because he's got a lot of money and he's had these big interventions into our world, the world we share, our ecologies. And we have embedded ourselves in this web of meaning where there are powerful people, where money has power. And this is all a destructive kind of meaning. In that web of meaning, a web of metaphors about power, people who have that supposed power think they are being rational. And they have an attitude of, well, if you're going to make a cake, you've got to break a few eggs. And that's why he goes around blowing up rockets. But this is the thinking of a mad scientist or a power-hungry politician. That's why we have to get out of these metaphors of power. We have to ask, what's the flow of meaning here? And we find that flow of meaning in meditation. We find the source of the flow of meaning. And we don't need to beat ourselves up if we haven't arrived at that silence yet. It's okay. It's just important to get on the path. And when we recognize that lack of silence, it can remind us. We can say, hey, you know, maybe I need to relax a little bit, not rush into anything. Because I don't have a whole lot of silence in my life. I don't have a whole lot of freedom in this mind here. I don't have as much quality thinking as I need and the world needs. And my thinking is happening in spite of myself right now. And I can consider myself very lucky to the extent that this thinking keeps me alive. But I know that nothing goes without consequences. There are consequences to our lack of freedom. We can try to think in spite of ourselves, but there will be consequences as we try to think in bondage. And we want to find a way to shift out of all that. We want to find our way to the same kind of thinking that created us, the thinking of nature, the thinking of mountains and rivers, forests and bees, whales and dolphins, horses, wolves and deer. Need to think ourselves into freedom. And that thinking happens in meditation, in that meditative mind, that it can appear in a lot of ways. Sometimes it appears in ceremony, ritual. Now we need to find our way to that freedom, that thinking. We want to need some more contemplation into all these things. But it's a good time for a break. So if you have any questions about any of this, the myth of freedom, the way of mountain thinking, send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of them into a future contemplation. At the very least, I'll try to respond with an email. I know I don't always bring things in to contemplation. Sometimes I do subtly. But I do love hearing from you. So, say hello, friend. And until next time, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of them.